Zach joined the Navy on November 10th, 2004. After 10 weeks of boot camp in Great Lakes, Illinois, he attended Hull Technician Basic Fireman School for 4 months. He then attended Detainee Operations Specialist School and 3 months of advanced infantry training in Camp McGregor. Zach did one 12-month combat tour in Iraq, where his unit conducted detainee operations. He also did one deployment aboard ship. Zach loved the camaraderie and life experience the Navy provided. He also loved the training and knowledge gained. Hello everyone, and welcome to Ghost Turd Stories. I'm your host, Troy Gent. Ghost Turd Stories' mission is using humorous and challenging stories from veterans and first responders to reduce the burden of families whose veteran or first responder took their own life. Ghost Turd Stories' vision is to use humorous and challenging stories to prevent suicide within our ranks and reduce the burden of families whose veteran or first responder took their own life. We hope to attract veterans and first responders, as well as those interested in knowing more about what it's like to be in our shoes while we wear or wore those shoes. At Ghost Turd Stories, we tell and write the stories of veterans and first responders for their families and friends. We love storytelling and believe there is nothing more inspiring and nothing that gets people to take action like a great story. Families and friends want to know the sacrifices we made, the services we rendered, and the people we lifted, so they can be inspired and learn about the legacy we left. Our podcast is the face of our company, but we want every family who cares to know about the experiences their veteran and or first responder went through for them. We interview veterans and first responders, collect pictures, write their stories, and compile them in a book for their families and friends to enjoy. Oftentimes, it's difficult for us to talk to our loved ones about what we did, saw, and heard while serving. At Ghost Turd Stories, we bridge the gap. For pricing, visit linktr.ee/ghostturdstories and click on the second tab directly under the podcast link called Let Us Write Your Story. That's linktr.ee/ghostturdstories. So welcome, Zach. It's great to have you. Thanks for joining.
Hey, Troy. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, you bet. It's an honor. And Zach is a referral from a Marine that I deployed with to Afghanistan. He was one of my team leaders in Afghanistan. And so far, I'm extremely impressed with Zach. So we'll go ahead and start off with the first question. What were some of the more memorable experiences in boot camp for you? The Navy calls it boot camp as well as the Marine Corps, and Zach was in the Navy. So go ahead, Zach, and tell us some things about boot camp.
Again, thanks for having me, Troy. It's a pleasure to be on doing something like this. Navy boot camp is your standard. I believe it's 10 weeks now. I want to say it was 8 to 9 for us. You never really know what you're getting into until you actually get into it. And once you sign that dotted line and get off that bus, and man, they start all hollering and screaming. And most of the time, I know there was about 5 or 6 of us that had partied the night before, so you didn't have to report to the indoc area or whatever it is before they bust you up to Great Lakes, Illinois.
You went to boot camp with a hangover?
Oh, yeah. Real, real bad hangover, man. I think I showed up maybe an hour and a half, 2 hours before we took off on the bus ride. And man, getting up, like, I mean, slept the whole way. I want to say it was like an 8-9 hour bus ride from Oklahoma MEPS all the way up to Great Lakes, Illinois. So got to sleep a little bit at off, but I mean, you know, waking up hungover, it's not the funnest thing in the world. But I remember getting the first taste of getting screamed at. I feel like we were one of the last units that actually they allowed, and they don't call them DIs, drill instructors. They call them RDCs. Can't remember exactly what that stood for, but ours weren't called drill instructors. They were called RDCs, but just screaming at you, why do you smell like booze? What the F is wrong with you? You can't even piss in a cup when we ask you to. The side, I guess, you kind of expect going into it is that somebody's going to scream at you, call you stupid, and you know, make fun of everything that you possibly can or cannot do. But one of the more memorable, really memorable moments going into it, and I guess you could call it a bonding experience for us uppers, but I was one of the section leaders. You had six section leaders that kind of equal to a petty officer, which would be a E4 above non-com. And then you'd have a kind of a chief equivalent, an E7 or above, that did cadence calling. And then you had this unit leader that was your quote-unquote officer.
Do they call you recruits too? So these are all recruits?
Yeah, these were all recruits. And we had this one dirtbag, and you'll laugh at why I call him a dirtbag later. But that was just bringing all our scores down. We were, I want to say we were in the top 5, top 3% of performances since they had kind of revamped the Naval boot camp in Doc whole deal. And so me and all the section leaders and our unit guy and everything, we all got together and we just completely sabotaged this dude's bunk kit and everything like that. So he would get asthma'd back when, you know, when you get sent back and you have to start all over again. And we all got busted for it, and we all got beat down, basically, you know, where they work you out until you start puking.
So did he get dropped, or?
He did get dropped. He got dropped to another unit. I think he ended up getting, he graduated with the next unit. He figured things out, but he was just that one odd man out that wasn't part of the, let's get this shit done with. We don't want to have people screaming at us all the time.
So the RDCs, they thrashed you for it. What do they call it? Not thrashing, but?
Beatdowns.
Did they not like him either, or did they?
No, they didn't. That was just one of those things they kind of explained, like, hey, you know, that's just, you know, unacceptable. It doesn't matter who the weakest link is. You can't.
Yeah, sure.
You can't dumb down the weakest link. You're supposed to bring up the weakest link. That's the whole point of being a leader. I remember we used to settle everything in house as much as you can, but at nighttime we had 5 to 7 empty bunks, and so we would line our mattresses, those empty mattresses in the shower, and we go in there and throw hands. That way nobody hit any tile or anything like that, and you can just wash blood away. And you'd set the mattresses up on the wall, and that way, you know, you stay in one corner and then you have people on the other one pushing you back in to stay around the mattresses so nobody got, you know, KO'd.
So it was like if someone had a problem with somebody else, you could just challenge them to a fist fight?
Yep.
Wow. And that was probably after lights out and stuff, late in the night?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Way, way past that. I mean, usually you'd have our higher-up RDCs coming back in, you know, checking, making sure we're performing watch correctly, but would put somebody trustworthy at watch during that time. That way we could actually have the altercation.
What was the most memorable altercation and why? Why were the participants pissed off?
So I'll include myself on this one because it probably was involved with me. There were two brothers. I want to say that their last name were Bennett's, and one was probably 3 or 4 years older than the younger one. And I ended up fighting the younger one because during the daytime, his older brother was fat and out of shape, basically. I was just sitting there ridiculing him for not being able to do push-ups and not being able to do sit-ups and come on, we're all doing this. This is maybe like day 5 or 6 too. And his little brother gets up right in the middle of all of us doing it. And we kind of get into a little shoving match and they break us up and they don't really punish us because I guess they're used to that happening in the first few weeks. And man, we went in there and let's see, I was 20 when I went in. And dude, this little 18-year-old, I mean, not going to lie, he caught me some good ones. I got him some good ones. And they only last probably 2-3 minutes. Everybody's so dang worn out that you can't really stay up too late at night.
Were the rules that you had to stay on your feet? There was no grappling? It was just all fists?
Yeah. You can't wrestle down on the ground. You're gonna scuff up on the tile, or you're going to smash somebody's head into the tile. Somebody could get, you know, head injuries and everything like that. No biting, no scratching, you know, try to leave as little blood as possible.
So after your fight with this kid, you guys connected both sides pretty well. And then after that, it was solved and settled?
Yeah. I mean, you kind of start understanding people, you know, you're like, hey, you know, man, you don't know me. I don't know you. We're all into this together. You know how guys can do it. Once you fight somebody, you usually end up being buddies with them.
Yeah. I had this roommate. I couldn't stand him. I went through boot camp with him, went through SOI with him. And then I thought I was rid of him, and then I got to my room in the fleet, and he was my roommate. And I'm like, oh man! And so we ended up becoming real good friends. So he probably thought the same of me, you know. So were there several fights like that?
There were three or four that I can really remember that were actual fights. A few other ones were just kind of hugging matches, a couple taps to the bodies, you know, people just kind of mad at each other, kids that never fought before.
Well, before we move on, is there anything else you'd like to touch on about boot camp?
I mean, we had one of the roughest winters in Chicago history. It was the 04-05, because I went November of 04 and then graduated, would be January of 05. And I remember kids from Texas volunteering to go shovel snow because they'd never seen it before. Well, we all laughed at them and stayed inside. there was fun stuff, but that was really the funnest that I can remember.
In Chicago, obviously in the summer, there's Navy boot camp, but you know they're in the sun and stuff. So in the winter, are they making you do push-ups outside, rolling the snow? Do they utilize the cold and the snow to punish you a lot?
As long as it's not like extreme and it's going to hurt somebody. I do remember going outside and getting marched in snow a few times, but I never saw someone get, you know, beat down or anything like that, or, you know, hey, go outside, you know, lay down, roll in the snow, get used to it. They had the pre-spec ops group that would stay there a little bit longer before they, you know, like the SEALs and the divers, and most of the naval special units, they had a little separate group, and I don't remember what they did very often, but they were a little more extreme.
Okay, so the guys that wanted to be Navy SEALs, they actually put them in separate platoons?
Yes, because they want to make sure that you're actually fit, because your physical fitness is going to be way different than what just normal Navy boot camp is going to be like. Those guys were swimming every day. They were running every day, push-ups, working out every day when we were doing a lot more blue jacket manual type, you know, classes, learning about naval history. And
their focus was just more physical fitness heavy.
Yeah, get them ready for buds because they're going to get the snot beat out of them.
Did you ever see a recruit do something that made the whole platoon suffer?
Not the whole platoon, honestly. We all got beat down a couple of times. Nothing I would say that, you know, should have cost us universal punishment. I mean, I was towards the end of our boot camp and everything, right before graduation, I remember a new group coming in, and one of the RDCs got in trouble. He actually lost his drill instructor billet because one of the kids turned him in. He wouldn't shower, so he brought him upstairs to our floor, and he put him in a mop bucket, and he had him saying, "I'm a smelly piece of, you know, poop." And he sprayed him with a Febreze bottle, and that RDC didn't get to come to our graduation, unfortunately.
So that was considered hazing.
Yeah. I mean, and the kid stunk to hell. I mean, he really didn't shower.
What was your MOS school?
MOS school was mostly hull technician. I don't know if you've seen many Navy guys' arm patches that's got their rating and stuff like that. They're different colors. Whites are mostly medics, reds are firemen. So these are like secondary bases on the ship and everything like that. Greens are topsiders, airedales, guys that are bomb builders, plane mechanics, flagmen, stuff like that would be green. Blue, I think, are yeomen and painters, boatsman's mates and stuff like that. But my subclass was a firefighter, so I got to go through welding, shipboard welding, plumbing, and then I got to go through a shipboard firefighting training as well. The welding school was fun and all. Taught you how to steel arc weld, brazing and stuff like that, basic plumbing and metal welding. But the shipboard firefighting training was a lot of fun because, I mean, you got to go in and you learn how to, if you're trapped in a flooding space, they'd literally flood the room and you're in there and they'd have shoring items to help you patch holes and stuff like that and try and stop the water from coming in. I mean, you got to do that. I want to say it was like for 2 weeks. You got to go to that little school where they taught you how to firefight. And then just flood you over and over again till you got it right, till you figured out how to stop the room from flooding on you. So I remember a few times, you know, before they drained it, you'd almost be out of room in there, and then they'd stop flooding it and drain the room out. Everybody'd get to leave and try it all over again.
So you went to MOS school, and then explain a little bit about your experience with going, doing combat training, and then being the only Navy unit since World War II to fulfill a combat role.
The fact that opportunity came up, I got real lucky. like I said, you'd laugh. Me calling a guy a dirtbag when I ended up turning it into a dirtbag. I'm sure you guys had the Joe Navy equivalents. But by the time that billet came up, it was just a voluntary IA, individual augmentee billets, where they just take, you know, regular standard MOS naval units and they pull them all together. It's from East Coast and West Coast. They send you over on a combat billet. So we went to Fort Bliss, Texas, and we did our training at Camp McGregor, New Mexico, where we went through 3.5-4 months for basic Army infantry and detainee operations training.
So you went to the Army infantry school.
Yep, yep. We all met up in Port Hueneme, California, at that naval base. We did all of our shots, you know, our pre-deployment shots before you go over to Iraq. And then we all flew down to Fort Bliss. And we got stationed up in there, and we stayed there for, like I said, 3.5-4 months. We got to go through and do hand-to-hand combat, urban operations, convoy operations, riot control. We got to go through you guys' fun, your OC spray gauntlet, where they spray in the face with early resin caps to come, and then you got to go through and take people down, and it's fucking awful. We didn't know that we were training for specifically detainee ops at the time, but that's what it mostly transition to towards the end of that 3 to 4 months.
Okay. And then after that 4 months, did you deploy to Iraq?
Yeah, we deployed to a small FOB called Camp Buka. Some people call it Abu Ghraib 2. And we were there for 9 months. It's just north of Umm Qasr. And we were originally supposed to go for 9 months. And then within the last, I think we were 45 days out from going home, and they involuntarily extended us for 90 more days. So we got to spend a full year in country.
And what was your mission there?
It was mostly detainee operations. So we would facilitate. Camp Buka was the largest internment facility in country at the time. And I believe at one point in time they had, I want to say, over 30,000 detainees. Not when I was there. I believe when we left, we had around 21 to 22,000 detainees. And we would basically go out and we'd assist, you know, Marine and Army and boots on ground actual infantry units that would capture possible insurgents or actual insurgents. And they would ship them over and they would wait their court date. So we'd have files on them, court. We'd book them in, dress them, house them appropriately. And these are all men, of course, no women. And we'd watch them.
So you were like basically corrections officers, but in combat.
Yeah. You know, we got mortared quite a few times, small arms fire, nothing wild. The real wild and crazy stuff were the riots when the prisoners were actually detainees were trying to escape. A lot of them were American educated. I remember one time we caught, I think it was seven of them. They had dug a tunnel. Ended up being a pretty intricate tunnel system, but they had dug out underneath one of the spotlights still within the compound. And all you see is this naked Arab fucking trying to run out, runs to a light, and he runs back. And you hear somebody go, "Escape, escape." And the alarm kicks on. All the lights, start, because it was nighttime, all the lights start flooding on to where they are. And you hear a couple of non-lethal rounds. Boop, boop, boop. No, Sergeant. No, Sergeant.
What was that like to deal with those detainees? Were they all hostile or were they trying to make friends with you? Or how did that all go down with some of them?
It was a mixed bag. I mean, we had a lot of high value. We had Al Baghdadi there when he was first caught before he started ISIS. And they say technically our unit was the one that facilitate ISIS. A lot of rock mail, you'd catch like their messages and trying to escape and whatnot. But you'd get a mixed bag. There'd be some guys that were real friendly, could speak English real well. A lot of them, like I said, were American educated and tried to appease you best they could. You know, they didn't want any problems. They wanted their compound to, you know, have good relations with other people. But I mean, there were other times. I know one of our guys named Joseph Ham. He was the only guy that actually got injured through a type of combat, but he got a little lazy and he went down. They had bracelets that had like a serial number on them that we'd sit there and we'd, you know, write the number down and that's who it is. That's who it matches with the picture. He reached down and he got stabbed in the neck with an old rusty nail shank. So we dealt with our fair share of them trying to come after us.
what was your understanding of the Abu Ghraib situation, that all that went down, and then what was the backlash that you guys experienced?
I had no knowledge. I was very much uninformed on my own account back in the day. I didn't care. I didn't know. I was fighting terrorists. That's all I needed to know is what I, back when I believed everything the government told me.
Okay. So now was this, you say it was Abu Ghraib too. Was it in the same location?
No, Abu Ghraib, I want to say it was north, up around like Fort Seuss or Fort Susie. I can't remember exactly what it was called, but yeah, we were all down, way down south.
Did you feel like you guys did a pretty good job as far as the way you treated the detainees and things, and you showed as much respect as you could?
I won't deny the guy that stabbed Joe, we kind of threw a beating, but there ended up being a new base commander. It ended up being some female Marine. She was the only Marine on base, oddly enough. We had Air Force, Army, and Navy, all three on the base. And most everyone was an MA or some type of police unit within the military. But we were a little rough when we first got there. And when she came and took over, there were a lot of NCIS investigations, a lot of questions had to be answered. And then there was a lot of reform in how we treated the detainees because, you know, technically they're not guilty of anything until they go up and see their court date.
It's interesting how that worked. I mean, there was a lot of things that they had us doing that we weren't really trained in. You know, you just get thrown in those roles and, okay, just do the best you can because we don't know how to tell you how to do it anyway because we don't know what we're doing. So everybody's just trying to figure it out, and then it's a little bit messy.
Yeah, you're the experimental pig.
Yep. After your combat mission, what was your career like after that?
Man, I didn't finish out too strong, I'd say. I probably only had 10 months left before I got out. I was definitely an alcoholic. I don't know if you remember tramadols, but tramadols were one of the big pain pills. One of the big pain pills they'd give you, you know, if you came back and you had any injuries or anything like that. And one of my hutmates from over there, he was just basically, he'd get 60 a month, 60 or 90, I can't remember. But all we'd do is drink and pop pills for a long time, long time. But man, I ran into some trouble. I had 8 days left before my EOS, before my early out, and I ended up picking up a DUI on base. They were basically just ready to separate me, so they kind of hurried it up even faster and got me out real quick. I don't know if it was because they didn't want to treat me or because I never got asked anything on my way out. You know, hey, are you dealing with anything? Is there anything wrong with you? They just kind of were like, hey, you're out of the military. Here's your papers, you know. GTFO.
I've been using Isagenics since 2017. These products have made a world of difference in my quality of life, health, energy, muscle definition, strength, and endurance. My bread and butter products have been the Daily Essentials multivitamins with Isagenesis, which is a telomere support supplement, the Isolene meal replacement shake, the Tri-Release protein shake, the collagen, the green drink, and the Cleanse for Life support system. However, Isagenics has many products and can cater to your unique lifestyle and goals. Click the link in the show notes or visit nmp.isagenics.com. Besides just using the products, there is an option to partner with me and the company to build your own business with no capital upfront. You can do as little as pay for your products and as much as making a full-time income. I love these products and will use them the rest of my life. For more information, you can email me at ghostturdstories@gmail.com.
I never spent more than a year on a ship. I was on the USS Carter Hall. I did the longest out at sea I did was 60 days. And they were just deployment workups. So they were about to go deploy, but I was getting out. So I wasn't technically part of it. And that kind of turned me really into a big, big dirt bag. I didn't get any of my watch qualifications. I got caught by my chief one time. I used to hide underneath the welding rags in the HD locker when we do general quarters. So general quarters, basically, they assign you to a safety locker somewhere on the ship that, you know, if we get attacked and they call GQ, you go to that locker, and there's certain firefighters, me being one of them. But I remember getting busted by my HTC for hiding underneath welding rags and just sleeping. Basically, I'd be hungover and peeled out, so I'd just sleep underneath the rags. He caught me about 3 months in. I know, looking back, I definitely wish I would have taken the post-deployment help that they offered. I remember it sounded so scary when they said you would come back, that you would have to do some type of detoxification, and they wouldn't let you leave. They wouldn't let you do anything, so you lied about being okay. That way you got to go just, you know, try and be normal and in the real world again.
What do you think was had the biggest impact on your post-traumatic stress, and why?
Man, honestly, having to deal with them. Dylan's told me some stories, so I know, and there's a few other guys I'm sure that maybe you've done or you've reached out to that also did actual combat tours over there, you know, returning fire, actual fighting people. I think the hardest part was actually having to be humane to them. The way they teach you how they are, and then you see how they are sometimes, and it's not all of them. It's definitely not. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, whatever, Arabs as a whole are all bad people or anything like that. But you go and pick somebody up and, you know, write down possible terrorist operations, and maybe that person hadn't done anything wrong at all. He was just out providing or doing something for his family. You don't really know. So I think that was the actual hardest part, was trying to humanize who they told you the enemy was, and then treat them fairly.
So why do you think that was? Was it just because, like, this person's a horrible human being and I have to treat him nice?
I think it was more based off of anger that I didn't get to fight him. Like, because, I mean, that's kind of what we all volunteered to go do. What they originally had trained us up to be was less detainee operations and more in the field. They switched on us at the end because the first naval, we were NPDB2, and the first naval unit was obviously NPDB1, and they were up on the Iran border at Fort Susi. It was an old Russian oil base or something like that. And they actually went out and I think did more real boots on ground stuff, infantry style stuff than we did. We were mostly detainee operations. Like I said, I think that was the hardest part, is that we weren't allowed to let out our aggression and our frustration. We're supposed to be fighting these guys, but, you know, instead I'm feeding them during Ramadan. I'm letting them pray twice a day. Humanizing the enemy.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense. You explained some of the things that you've gone through and suffered as far as that post-traumatic stress. What kinds of things do you do to help manage that, live a functional and productive life?
Self-awareness is a big deal. Knowing what triggers you, and knowing how to either talk or breathe your way out of it, because you can't change it. I mean, you can kind of change how you approach it, but most of the time you're going to feel that way. The first thing that's going to come to your head is, you know, effing Muslims, or look at this brown, blah, blah, blah. I still struggle with it. And I know I've been through a lot of anger management and therapy classes to kind of help myself learn these little techniques. You know, maybe you take in a couple extra breaths. You know, if somebody on the road ticks you off and you feel it kind of rising up inside of you, pull over. If it costs you 5 minutes, it costs you 5 minutes. It's not gonna be the end of the world. But if you actually act upon your anger and your frustration, you're more than likely gonna do something stupid that's regrettable. That's kind of what therapy and going to some classes. Go to classes. They teach you a lot. I know it doesn't sound tough or anything like that, but I hope if anybody takes it away from this, is that they have classes. The VA is a lot better than it used to be, and they have the resources to help us out.
How did you overcome your drinking and popping pills challenges?
Man, I think that just, I didn't beat it for a long, long time. I would honestly say I've only recently conquered alcohol. Last maybe like 5-6 years, and that took some extra stuff in life that kind of made me not want to do it. Divorce, moving to another location helped me do that. Getting away from my easy everyday party pals, because I mean, we all develop that group that we feel super secure around, that we can go out and drink and act like a total clown, and more than likely they're either going to end up in jail with you or they're going to keep you out of jail. The best way for me to beat that was just literally taking myself out of the situation and developing better habits.
Awesome. Well, Zach, is there anything else that you'd like to share with us? Any other stories that came to your mind while we were talking?
I'll give you kind of a quick run up of what I was like in the Navy. So we had the whole debauchery that we did in boot camp. Well, getting out, going into A school, they had the, it was certain phases of liberty. That's what it was. So at Great Lakes, when you got out, it didn't matter if you were 21, you know, we're all of age, of course, being 18 when you get out, but we had phases of liberty at Great Lakes in the A school to where you had to earn your way to where you could stay out all night. I was in A school for, I believe, 5 months, 4 or 5 months, and not one single time did I actually have real deal phase three liberty where I got to stay out all night. So I saw my first chief's mass whenever I was in A school, and that was for sneaking out outside of my liberty phase. And I stayed out all night. I got super drunk, came back in, and there was a cutout along the fence, so you didn't have to check your card in with the gate guards. So we all could sneak back in, and you know, you just had some little fence ties, and you'd tie the fence back together, go sneak back into your room. And I woke up, I was in the wrong room. It was an unmanned room. There was nobody in that room. I wake up, and they called them ships, but our building commander, our ship commander, he was a second class, so an E5. He come in there, Hamilton, where the F you been? Are you serious? I can't believe this. I'm hazy, hungover. I'm 21 years old. I don't really know how to respond. I've been here all day. Well, my buddy forgot to turn off his card. That's how I got caught. And so that second class, literally, he looks at my shoes. This is when Steve Madden's were really, really, really popular, and they had that rigid cut on the bottom of it. And it had just snowed. And he went outside and he looked out at the window and he looked up and picked my shoes up. And he goes, huh, Zach, you think these shoes are going to match those footprints outside this window in this empty room you're sleeping in? And I just kind of chuckled and I was like, no, they're not. Those are mine. Man. And he was actually cool about it, though. He gave me a coins toss chance. And he goes, all right, I'll give you an option. Pick the side of the coin. If you win it, you have to give a 300-word essay on what you did wrong and how you're going to improve about being a good sailor. And if not, you go to Chief's Mass. And I didn't pick the right side of the coin, so I had to go up and see a bunch of chiefs. That's kind of like Captain's Mass. Article 57, basically. And you just go in front of a bunch of enlisted chiefs and they just kind of talk crap to you and tell you what a POS you are. And then you get grounded. You know, you get half month's pay times two and you got duty restriction. And so I saw two chiefs mass while I was in and I saw three captain's masses, all for alcohol related incidents.
Well, Zach, thanks so much for being on here with me, and I really appreciate it. And I know that with your success in overcoming, you know, your alcohol and pain meds and your management of post-traumatic stress, I know that some listeners will benefit from that. So I really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. I say if I had to give one message out to them, just if at the very least, talk to somebody. Please talk to somebody.
Well, thanks again, Zach.
Yep, it was a pleasure being on here, Troy. I thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening. Please tell your friends and family so that we can bring more joy and awareness to those struggling with suicide ideation and the families who desperately need help after the loss of someone they love to suicide.